Well, folks, the gentleman who we're about to have a conversation with, Joe DeLong, who's the CEO and executive director of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, we'll be calling it CCM when we're referring to it over the conversation. But equally important, he's president, maybe more important, he's president of the board for the Foundation Foundation for Youth. And these folks recently, back in October, released a comprehensive plan to tackle the growing crisis of disconnected youth in Connecticut. This plan, titled Young People First, a bold plan to address Connecticut's statewide crisis, represents a significant milestone in ongoing efforts to address and remedy the challenges faced by young people who are disconnected from education and employment. We're going to talk all about this effort and this report and what we're going to do about these young people to get them re-engaged and reconnected. But first, I want to connect you with another group that's near and dear to my heart, and I know it is to Joe, too. I'm talking about the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. They're looking to recognize leaders working across Connecticut to improve the lives of domestic violence survivors and their kids at the 14th annual First 100 Plus Breakfast and Awards Ceremony. People across Connecticut have been stepping up in their local communities to support survivors and ensure access to the life-saving services provided by CCADV's 18 partner organizations. Do you know somebody from your community or profession who goes above and beyond when helping survivors and their families? Perhaps a law enforcement officer, an educator, a medical practitioner, attorney, or faith-based leader? If so, please share their story and nominate them to be honored by clicking on the events tab at ctcadv.org. All right, Joe DeLong, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me on.
So, not like you're busy enough with CCM, but again, this effort, Young People First, is so critically important. Let's talk about CCM and some of the reasons behind the Foundation for Youth's inception.
Yeah, well, you know, CCM really led the charge on this thing that was referred to as the 119K Commission, the 119 number representing the 119,000 disconnected and young people, or disconnected and at-risk young people across the state who were either at risk of not graduating high school or have graduated but aren't secondary, aren't post-secondary education or don't have a job. They're not, you know, really involved or engaged in society. And it's a real crisis in the state. And what that led to was a report that you'd mentioned, a report called Young People First. It has 22 aligned actions that the committee felt strongly needed to be taken to reduce that population by half over the next decade. And to support that work, this foundation was created. Really, because throughout the process of doing this work, there were so many other contributors besides CCM. And I think the mayors and first selectmen wanted to keep all of those different organizations engaged and involved because they were so valuable in the process. So now what you have is this spinoff foundation that's still under the CCM umbrella, but it includes representatives from the business community and from the education community and from the nonprofit community. So it's led by a larger umbrella. There's more entities under that umbrella than just our mayors and first selectmen.
So when you say, I think you're painting with a really broad brush when you're saying at-risk and disconnected youth, but how does that fit into a frame that can be addressed? It just seems like it's just too big a number to even collectively get our arms around across 169 cities, towns, and boroughs.
So I think the one thing you said there is really important, across the 169 cities and towns and boroughs, because a lot of people from the outside would look at something like this and think that maybe it's just an urban issue or maybe it's just an urban poor issue. That's really not the case. This is a challenge. It's a crisis that's impacting literally every town and city and borough across the state of Connecticut. So that's, and because it exists in every one of our communities, it has to be tackled in every one of our communities. Everybody has to lean into it. And there are different areas of this. There are areas in education. There are areas in workforce. We certainly have, I think, as many people have become aware of it that just live here, we certainly have a very challenging tax code system that creates massive inequities because we over-rely on property taxes so much to fund educational services. That is a huge portion of this, that until the state is actually willing to lean in and change that, we're always going to have some challenges. But the other thing, if you look at this report, right at the very beginning, right out of the gates in the first couple of recommendations, talks about how when a young person moves through the system, they get lost. Very, very quickly they get lost. If they move from, they might actually be getting all the support services that they need in one town. When they move to another town, if the support services that they were receiving aren't available by that same entity in that new town that they're moving to, there's no transfer of information. They simply fall through the cracks. We have a 211 system that was built in the mid-1970s. It's really never been upgraded since then. So you have young people, if they even know to reach out to 211, they can reach out and say something like, hey, I've been sleeping on my friend's couch for the last 6 weeks, and tomorrow they have company coming, and I have to leave, and I don't have anywhere to go. And what they're going to be told by 211 is, well, right now you're on the couch, you're not homeless yet. So once you're actually out physically on the street, call us back. Mm. I mean, so it's really a broken system in that way, too, in regards to getting people, the young people, the support services that they need and keeping those support services consistent as they move, as they age out. That's part of it. As they get older, maybe they are getting services while they're in high school, but the moment they age out of high school, the services drop, or as they move across our communities. And so that's a big part of this as well, is just building out that network in a better way that we're able to get immediate supports to young people when they need them so we can keep them on track.
Mm. So this report rolled out in early October. Here we are, approaching, middle of February. What are a couple of the things that the foundation and your fantastic board have already sought to take a bite into in terms of that punch list of initiatives that you've defined?
Yeah, well, there's certainly some issues on the workforce side where we're making a lot of headway with the General Assembly of programs that already exist and are actually working very well that just need to be expanded in terms of their capacity. You know, we have a lot of really good workforce programs that are very successful, but they're limited and you end up with long waiting lists. And so we're working with the governor and the General Assembly and others to eliminate that problem, you know, that those waiting lists, and actually point out that the return on investment in those areas is actually very high. What a lot of people don't realize with these young people who are at risk and disconnected, you're talking about $5.5 billion a year in lost GDP growth for the state of Connecticut by not addressing this issue. So there are a lot of areas where we can make some very modest investments for some very large returns. And so that's one of the areas in the workforce. We're also leaning in very heavily and starting to have conversations with more in the philanthropic community. This doesn't all have to be government or taxpayers or even the nonprofits, but there's a partnership that has to take place more broadly with the philanthropic community. And those conversations are going very well in a variety of areas. But I've got to tell you right now, one of the most core foundational areas of this work that the foundation is really leaning into heavily this session is addressing the inequities in the education cost-sharing formula at the state level and how that leads to so much of this disconnection. Most people aren't aware that if the state had done nothing at all with the ECS formula going back to 2017, other than put an inflationary adjustment on it. So if the state simply kept everything the same but increased its spending with the rate of inflation, The state of Connecticut is spending $654 million more today on public education than what it was spending in 2017. Now, that what happens is, because the state doesn't keep up, the state's proportional share of public education goes down, and that proportional share gets shifted into the local property tax. And some communities actually can find a way to pick up that difference and raise the property taxes and raise the revenues. Other communities can't raise property taxes enough to keep pace with that. Mm. And so the services start getting eliminated. There becomes more inequities, more challenges. It was funny. I was meeting with some legislators the other day who really didn't believe that the state underpaid these districts that much. And I said, well, let's just point out our neighbor in Massachusetts. If you look at the 10 lowest spending districts in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts state government contributes a little over $14,000 per student in those 10 lowest districts. In Connecticut, we contribute at the state level around $10,000 per student. There's a 40% difference in how much the state of Connecticut contributes at the state level to its lower districts than what Massachusetts does. Mm. But what's really interesting, when you look at Massachusetts, on the richest districts, the wealthiest districts, they contribute about 6% more at the state level to the wealthier districts than what we do here in Connecticut. So from a taxation policy alone, we drive a lot of inequity.
Yeah.
Because the state
that candle's burning at both ends.
Yeah, the state, I mean, I hate to say it this way, but the state of Connecticut, when it comes to public education, just doesn't pay its bill. Mm. And by not paying its bills, and this administration has been particularly poor, you know, over these last 6 or 7 years, by not keeping up, by not paying its bills, this problem is getting worse and worse, and the pressures on our local communities keep going up and up. And
right.
We have to reverse that if we're ever going to solve this.
Right, right. And then you overlay that with the concept that the largest cities have the proportionally largest population of these disengaged and at-risk youth. And they're the ones that you know, kind of, you know, have to make peanut butter sandwiches. And, you know, it's like they've got to take care of them all by mandate. And yet there's more of them with greater need. And those are the communities that are proportionately having to do all of that with less.
And yet with less is the point. So the people who have the highest needs also have the least access to resources. So it's really a dangerous combination. When you have the highest needs, yet you have the least access to resources, it creates those massive, you know, disparities and those massive inequities. And what comes out of that? What we saw in Hartford, what comes out of it? You have somebody who came all the way through the public education system in Connecticut, who graduated after coming all the way through the public education system in Connecticut, that can't read or write. I mean, that's not a good recipe for our economic future here in the state.
Well, aside from, you know, gracing our group of stations here at Connoisseur Media with your presence and your message, what are some of the other strategies that you and your board are going to be using to implement and to broaden the reach of the most important things people need to know?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it is very, very community-based. Right now, the board is looking at putting together a speakers bureau that will go out into communities, whether it's at a Rotary Club or whether it's an evening group within a church or, you know, whatever is the opportunity to get to the core of a community and to just sit down and explain the issue to people a little better so they understand it and they can have their questions answered. Because, you know, right now there is so much misinformation. You know, I'll see things where people will talk about how Connecticut spends more on public education than any other state. No, we don't. We spend more at the local level than any other state, but we don't spend more than any other state. You know, there's a whole lot of just misinformation. People feel that, well, our educators are overpaid here. Their salaries are so high and there's so much waste. Actually, the median salary for our educators here in Connecticut falls slightly below what the living wage is. That's pretty remarkable when you think about it, that we're asking our educators to do things and take on the challenges that they take on when their pay is actually incredibly low for what the cost of living here is. Most people don't realize that when it comes to counselors and social workers and the people who are needed in our school system to help deal with all of the challenges that a young person comes into the system with from home, whether it's food insecurity or housing insecurity or some other type of abuse or neglect, or whether they just need some post-graduation direction about where do I go to stay on track. We're looking in some cases the caseloads of those counselors being 500 students to one. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's impossible. It's absolutely impossible to give the support, the psychological support or the other counseling or help that these young people need with caseloads of 501.
We see some of the more better equipped, the more affluent communities, when it comes time for their political leadership or their citizens to come forward and endorse annual budgets. We are seeing boards of education having to hold the line or even peel back, which once again is just another facet of this black diamond that that we're holding up to the light here, that is contributing to the problem that spawned what we're talking about, and is being an impediment to the solution that your board and your organization is trying to seek.
Well, I think one of the things that's so telling about that, when you look at local budgets and you look at the state budget, earlier, just recently, the governor, put out his budget proposal, which will be amended and will change, but put out his budget proposal, and he talked about how there was more money in it for education because this issue is becoming a hot button issue. But in other areas of his budget, he actually reduced municipal aid or reduced municipal spending. But when it all shakes out, our cities and towns under that proposal are pretty much flat funded, with some of them even going in the negative and mm-hmm. losing money. Mm-hmm. And so what's remarkable about that is we're on a period of two things that I'll say are remarkable. Number one, we're on a run of 7 years of budget surpluses at the state level. So 7 years of budget surpluses at the state level with no additional investment at the local level driving property taxes up. That is one of the things that I think should be shocking, absolutely shocking to people to understand that we are not investing at the state level in our local communities. The other thing that should be shocking to people is the state budget proposal has gone up by $1 billion. So there is $1 billion of new spending in this budget. But none of that $1 billion has been prioritized to increase the revenues in our communities to be able to provide for these types of services and to make sure that our kids are getting what they need to be properly educated and to be contributing members of society. So when you have these types of challenges and this type of crisis in the face of budget surpluses and $1 billion of new spending, and our towns and cities are flat funded on the other side of that, I personally think that shows, a real tone deaf nature to what our communities need and what the people of Connecticut need at this time.
Mm. Well, certainly a potent package of facts there, Joe, to give folks something to think about here on this Sunday, or if they're listening on the podcast, it's time for us to step up to help our at-risk and disconnected youth. This organization that is now Young People First and their foundation, the Foundation for Youth, are beginning their work mark here after just a few months after the release of their report. And we very much appreciate the work that's being done. If people want to learn more, they can just go to ccm-ct.org/youngpeoplefirst to access all the background information, to read the report. There's a number of different downloads. If you want to really dig in deep, you can get the whole report. You can download quick references, you know, smaller snippets of information to take and share with your group. And I'd say, leaving the conversation at this point, Joe, the best thing that I think folks in communities across Connecticut could do is to reach out to CCM to be among the first to engage your board members and other volunteers that are coming out to these communities in the Speakers Bureau. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you very, very much for your time this morning, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation about this subject and hearing some success stories. Thank you so much, Joe DeLong.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
From a meeting at the office to a big first day, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every event. But clothes don't make the man. So why stuff your closet with things that only work for some situations? With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting. Their clothing is understated and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They craft each piece by combining timeless style and modern performance materials, so you can stay looking good and feeling comfortable from morning to evening. No wardrobe changes required. Browse everything from summer-ready tech linen shorts and anti-odor polos to tailored sweats and crews for a night in. They can outfit you for anything, no matter what's on your agenda for the day. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.